these articles, multiple articles, were saying that the primary emotion that mothers encouraged in children under five, Indian mothers or South Asian mothers, mostly Indian studies, was happiness. And then once they reach the age of six and higher, happiness is deprioritized. And then we're focused on, you know, the realities of the world, the, you know, the trials of the world.
Yeah.
Just to be, to attempt to desensitize a child in a way. It is a desensitizing of a child. It's still a very young age, like still before the kid is even 10 years old, we've started to deprioritize happiness.
It's almost like waiting to, not even waiting, it's almost like breaking your own child's heart before they turn into a teenager. It's very sick.
Yeah.
I've been through it.
We all have.
We all have. I've 100% been through it.
There's like a deeper meaning behind all of this. Like it's how you were raised, what you were taught, what you were conditioned to believe.
This is the Desi Condition.
Hello, hello, bondus. Welcome back to the Desi Condition. I'm Tanushree. I am the creator of the show. I'm joined today by Anu, who is the Desi Condition's communications lead. Hey, Anu.
How's it going, Tanushree? Happy Sunday.
Happy Sunday to you, too. We're discussing something actually quite not that happy, but happiness is going to be a big topic of discussion, actually. So we're discussing something very near and dear to me personally, the emotional intimacy in parent-child relationships, particularly among South Asians. So this was inspired by a book that we both just read. It's called Adult Children of Emotionally Immature Parents by Lindsay C. Gibson. And I read it and I immediately was like, oh no, you have to read this book. And I sent her a copy and she was like, oh my God. And we found out, this was like 2 years ago, and we just found it kept coming up in conversation, and we decided, you know what, like we have to talk about this on air. And one of the big criticisms that we took away from this is that it was more general and not really at all culturally specific or inclusive. And so we wanted to branch out and kind of add an arm to it. So this is the first of a two-part episode. I like to think of this part as like the cultural parenting style origin story. So part two's episode will be more about identifying immaturity and some actionable steps towards healing. So for this episode, we chose to take an inquiry approach on this topic. And basically what that means is that Anu and I began to interrogate our own childhood experiences with our parents, well, along with just general rhetoric we've heard from people in our communities growing up in New York City and New Jersey. And in that process, we discovered the questions that we really wanted the answers to. All right, Anu, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. So just some background. Tanushree sent me this book in the mail 2 years ago. I started reading it and I found it to be really heavy, so I had to put it down. I don't think I got through it the first time that I read it. And fast forward, it's been 2 years, and Tanushree hits me up and is like, hey, we should do an episode on this, just you and I. So I finally finished the book from start to finish, and there's so many little nuggets and takeaways, but we wanted to just kind of prime you guys first before we get into some of the heavy stuff that this book covers. There is a very, very different perspective as a South Asian, I feel, and some of the tools and strategies that the book brings up don't really apply to me and don't really apply to Tanushree, but some of them really heavily apply. So we wanted to kind of find some of those synergies and pose some questions for you guys to think about as you listen to the next two episodes and kind of go through this journey with us. So these are some of the questions that we came up with and try to distill it down to. First, how important is emotional intimacy in South Asian parent-child relationships? Second, what does successful parenting look like in South Asian culture, and how did that come to be? And lastly, what is the impact of the way South Asian culture views and deals with emotions on the wellness and socialization of their children? So these are really heavy questions.
Yeah, I think our impression in general, and when I say our, I mean collectively as a generation, of South Asian parenting is that it responds sort of to social context, to it breeds guilt culture. It is heavily patriarchal, prioritizes obligation, loyalty, and obedience. And so when we ask this first question that has to do with the importance of emotional intimacy between parents and children, there really wasn't a lot of research on this. And so we started turning to anecdotal research instead. So we ended up finding a few Reddit comments that we think in general echo the sentiment among millennial and Gen Z South Asians about their parents.
Yeah, so I'm gonna read a few, and I'm gonna have Dhanushree read off one more. But these were some that I found on Reddit, which I love so much. Always fun being great on Reddit. These really spoke to me because I think that they really nicely encapsulate a lot of the conversations that I've had with other South Asians about this topic. So one user named We Are All Mad Here states, low emotional maturity is because of colonialism and oppression. It's forced generations to be in survival mode, and that reduces emotional maturity and responsiveness to connection. Because when we are in survival mode, emotions have little use to us. We then instead learn to feel good about objects, things, achievements, status as a substitute, and then we end up with learning things like, mom doesn't know how to say she loves me, but she's proud when I do well in school. I want that emotional response from her, so I'm going to get a job that makes them proud. And then shoving our own emotions aside just to continue the cycle.
I love this person's username.
Yeah.
We are all bad here. What a succinct response to everything that we are feeling in this episode. I love this comment because it emphasizes colonialism and oppression, and we are definitely going to reference that too. The next comment we found is by a commentator named Indian PhD student. It says, they only see physicality. They will fuss about you not eating enough food or wearing a jacket while it's cold outside and take care of your physical needs. And they think that's it. That is parenting. Emotional needs are not something they understand. You're depressed? Why? You have a roof over your head and never went hungry. We had it much worse. It's like colors outside of the visible spectrum. You might as well say that there is an invisible fairy sitting on my shoulder and you need to do things to appease this invisible fairy. They just cannot see emotional needs.
Yeah, that one really spoke to me. I feel like that second comment really speaks to how as children we're kind of taught not to have those emotional expectations from our parents because it's just something that they don't know how to do and will never learn how to do. So
and I want to like challenge that a little bit too in this episode. Like, is it that they cannot like, is that really the case? What do they really know about emotion? Yeah.
And then lastly, I came across this comment from a user named Honorant. Again, another great name. one thing contributing to stunting emotional development is that Asian cultures highly regard the idea of toughness and strength. Exploring emotional development in any way, personal relationships, or general empathy means that you will allow yourself to be vulnerable and show vulnerability. That is a sign of weakness to them. So they simply don't go there. It's related to their denial of mental health and well-being that it doesn't exist or that it's complete quackery.
Quackery. That's a great word. I really like this selection of Reddit comments because I think they touch on all the things that are so different, but all the things that keep coming up. So we've got our colonialism and oppression. We've got physicality over emotionality. And more general South Asian, or actually more general Asian cultural views of toughness and strength.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that the toughness and strength piece comes up a lot in conversation around socialization for men versus women. But I really like that they brought this up in the context of our culture because it shows that it's not just a gender issue, that it's actually a cultural issue. It's deeper than just man versus woman. So I do want to explore that a bit too. But yeah, these were just a few comments that I found on Reddit. The topic that we're getting into today and in our next episode is not something that is overtly spoken about, and there's not much research on it. So Dhanashree and I took the time to really dive deep into our own histories and some of the questions that we ourselves had. So I know that for myself, I've had grandparents that survived partition, and so I knew that was a big that was something that I had that I was aware of as a child and growing up, but it was something that was never spoken about, not in depth at least. But I knew that there were some impact and some sort of long-term effects that that impacted my parents as well as myself. So I guess the next question or the next piece of our episode can be centered
Well,
around.
can I actually make a quick comment before you get there?
Yes, please. I'm derailing.
I think this is why we have two hosts, right?
Right.
I was about to say toast because I'm hungry. I think a very easy explanation for the roots of this kind of widespread emotional immaturity is generational trauma, colonialism, war, et cetera, et cetera. And this occurs a lot in the South Asian mental health like blogosphere or South Asian wellness slash history like blogosphere, especially like if you're scrolling on Instagram, TikTok, like you will see this rhetoric a lot. And I fully agree. We both fully agree and acknowledge these things. Personally, I don't feel like there's anything out there that I don't think that there's anything we can say that isn't already out there. I don't feel like there's much that we can really add to that portion of the conversation that isn't already out there by other creators or publications. And so I kind of just wanted to, I don't know, when I like both took this approach of India existed before partition, right? During British rule, even pre-British rule. And so, like she said, we dove pretty deep. And so this is kind of what we're trying to figure out what psychiatry and psychology looked like in those times. So, Anu, I think you found you were looking into partition mental health.
Yeah, so like I mentioned, partition was something that affected my maternal side, and so it was something that I was always aware of as a child, but I never really understood the impact, and there were no conversations around the impact. It was just more of like we had to survive, and we had to migrate to India. So when the question of psychiatry and mental health services and resources during a time as traumatic and as chaotic as partition, where did it stand? Well, that was my question. And so I found some research on this. And going into it, I had this notion of like, well, why was there so much silence? And like, why does there continue to be so much silence? And there are reasons behind that. So part of the reason for Indian psychiatry's silence was that it was still in its infancy in 1947 and was mainly confined to the asylum. So in the years following partition, psychiatrists were preoccupied with the upheaval and disruption of healthcare services. In the book, The Psychological Impact of the Partition of India, psychiatrists Sanjeev Jain and Alok Sarin explore the partition's impact on planning and delivery of psychiatric and other healthcare services, exploring the interface between politics, civic life, and medicine in 1940s India. And in the book, we learned that the silence of psychiatrists was not because of a lack of awareness that there would be severe and long-standing psychological consequences. In fact, there was an awareness around those consequences, but the documenting of the psychological trauma, as well as the provision of relief, was left to local family and community networks and a few charitable organizations. So there were just not enough resources. The distancing of the mental health professions from the events of the partition had lasting consequences for how psychology and mental health were thought about in South Asia, and we feel those effects till today. And there is also a stigma around it till today. So individuals became redefined as a part of community and clan networks and a perverse affirmation of the colonial gaze. There is so much to unpack here. I don't even know where to begin, honestly.
So it kind of sounds like there was some kind of system set up, at least for people who are severely mentally ill, in a way that's more outwardly obvious. But even that infrastructure crumbled during that partition period. So any progress was stymied because of that. So I think that this is one of those examples that proves that it's a little bit unfair for us to say our parents simply don't get it, because I think that they get it on some kind of deeper intrinsic level. But they didn't have the emotional infrastructure, you could say, to really understand and process that stuff.
I think that they weren't even allowed. I don't even think that they were allowed to grieve. I think that it was almost like, if you even take a second to grieve, you will not survive. Like, the pain is too much to bear. Mm-hmm. And I think that was probably the only thing that I was able to communicate with my grandfather about when he was still alive, because it affected him on such a deep level. He couldn't really talk about what it did to him, but he would talk about how overwhelming it was and how he's just happy that he's not there anymore and that he's was able to survive. And it was really just that story of, like, I was able to survive. I was able to, you know, find a roof over my head, find a job, make sure my siblings were taken care of, create a life for myself. Like, and it was really just like the picking up and moving on aspect that I got any sort of insight into, but really nothing else. Like, that part was probably the only part that I got any insight from him on, but nothing outside of that. And so when you think about an entire generation of people that are broken and traumatized and just don't know what to do with all this pain, like, all they want to do is move forward, you know, of course that carries on. Of course that affects them and will affect the way that they parent as well.
You know, it's interesting. My dad was living in what's now Bangladesh at the time. So he was like a small kid at the time, at 1947, but he remembers it. And so, you know, our family's Hindu. They decided that this part of India is now East Pakistan. So Hindus were evacuating at the time. Because even though, well, Bangladesh was not established as a Muslim country, but Pakistan was. So Hindus were evacuating. And so he, the one time he mentioned that evacuation experience, he mentioned being on a ship to India and like how crowded it was, like just bodies packed. And that was the one time he talked about it. And I was like in my late 20s already when he talked about it. Anything that I've heard about his childhood has been post that trip on the ship. It's been him moving around India, like staying with different relatives across the country because they didn't really have like a permanent home, siblings being separated from each other, how he didn't grow up with like even his sibling who's closest in age to him for several years, like just all this crazy stuff, but no like real context on it until he mentioned the night that he left what's now Bangladesh. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, that is crazy.
I thought that everyone had a chaotic life in India. I mean, and they did. They did. But I didn't understand why.
Yeah. You don't know why. You just know that it happened and that you should be grateful that you're here, and you should be grateful that you live in America and have all these rights and liberties and I mean, you know, to some extent, like there's so much truth to that, but when you want to dive deep into your history and, you know, ask these questions, like I almost felt like I knew not to ask those questions. Like don't ask why, you know, just don't ask
it's
why.
It's very much like a move on response to negative emotions. So there was a article that I was reading in the Journal of Child and Family Studies, and the article was called Asian Indian Immigrant and White American Maternal Emotional Socialization and Child Socioeconomic Functioning. It's a really long name, published in 2015. We're going to post this article up on the website at tdcpodcast.com after this episode airs. It's a very interesting read, but basically they're saying that they found that Indian mothers considered negative emotions to be inevitable, not that they ignored them altogether, but inevitable, but taught their children a move on response to negative emotions. So there's a more emphasis on a practical approach, or what they see as practical approach to emotion. That's basically the aim, is to not let them disrupt their daily activities and relationships. And the big emphasis was harmony in family. I mean, we know that our South Asian culture is a highly collectivist culture, right? So harmony. I think, and in light of those findings, it would be interesting to see what a non-supportive response, actually, because this is considered a more supportive response, a non-supportive response in the present day might be, that would be a more moving on type of response or something else.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about this more in part two of this episode, well, this series, the dismissiveness and rejection of emotional expression in children, and how parents will often, like one way that a parent can respond to an emotional response from a child would be to directly shut down, reject it, and to dismiss it. From the context of like South Asian parenting and like some of their belief systems, and the influences that we will cover and have covered so far in this episode, it's really important to understand that when you're coming from a place of survival, when you're coming from a place of practicality, there may be no room for emotional expression. There may be no reason to have any sort of emotional expression. It's almost like you're supposed to deny those emotions. You're supposed to contain it within yourself and to internalize it and to deal with your emotions on your own. But as a child, what does that do to you? How do you develop into an adult that can emotionally regulate? Like, is that even possible if you're taught not to do that at such a young age? We talk about this a lot in part two, and just the effects of like what emotionally immature parenting does to a child. But there's two categories in which a child can go. They can either internalize or externalize, and again, we'll talk about this later. But it's very interesting how these sorts of parents, even though they may mean well and they may just be passing on what they have known to work themselves and what they have lived through themselves and how they have survived up until now, like how does it work in the context of the next generation? Like how does an entirely new generation adopt some of these principles that no longer work anymore, that aren't healthy and that don't make sense in this new world, in a new country even, because so many of us are born here. You know, they're born in the United States, born in Canada, London, wherever you're based out of. So many of us are operating from these like models of these belief systems that go back to India, that go back to Bangladesh, Pakistan, Nepal, Sri Lanka, wherever you're from. It's very interesting to see how we carry some of that trauma in our day-to-day lives, and just as simple as not being able to express our emotional selves and not being able to express our smallest emotions, and just having to doubt ourselves is very interesting to me, because it's not something that we often think about.
You know, I read in some articles that Indian moms, and as a side note, by the way, it's interesting that all these articles that I was reading about parent emotional socialization had more to do with moms than dads, but that's an aside. That's somewhat relevant, actually.
Yeah, it is relevant.
But the point that I'm making right now is that it was saying these articles, multiple articles, were saying that the primary emotion that mothers encouraged in children under five, Indian mothers or South Asian mothers, mostly Indian studies, was happiness. And then once they reach the age of six and higher, happiness is deprioritized. And then we're focused on, you know, the realities of the world, the, you know, the trials of the world.
Yeah.
Just to be to attempt to desensitize a child in a way, it is a desensitizing of a child it's still a very young age, like still before the kid is even 10 years old, we've started to deprioritize happiness.
It's almost like waiting to not even waiting it's almost like breaking your own child's heart before they turn into a teenager. It's very sick.
Yeah,
I've been through it.
We all have.
We all have. I've 100% been through it.
So So I was reading about more. I got interested. I got really interested in emotional socialization in the Indian cultural context. And so I was reading this journal, another online journal called the Online Readings in Psychology and Culture Journal. And there was an article published in 2023 that talks about different emotional supportive strategies from parents. And so basically, and this is something that I read in a couple other studies too, the idea is that there's three supportive strategies and three unsupportive strategies. And when I read them, I'm going to read it verbatim from this particular article. And you might start to recognize your parents in these. Okay, so I'll start with these supportive strategies. The first one is number one, problem-focused reactions. Parents help the child to cope with the negative emotion related to the problem. Number two, emotion-focused response. Parents use comforting responses to help child feel better. And number three, expressive encouragement. Parents validate emotion expression of child. So then there's the three non-supportive strategies. Okay, so the first one is punitive reactions. Parents tend to punish, scold, or spank the child to reduce the need to cope with their emotions. The second one is minimization of reactions. Parents devalue the seriousness of child's emotions. And six, distress reactions. Parents experience distress due to child's emotions. I know which one my parents are.
Ooh, my parents are a nice little mix of a few.
I know which ones they are, I should say.
Right. It wasn't the comforting response. It wasn't the distress response. It wasn't number three, the expressive encouragement. That was not a thing. Definitely problem focus, yeah. One. Problem focus, five, minimizing reactions. Mm-hmm. You know what's interesting? I know we don't talk about this in the episode, but they're all very masculine responses. Like there's feminine energy response, and then there's masculine energy response. I have 100% experience like masculine energy responses, and that's all that I thought was normal and acceptable and okay for like 30 years of my life. And then I started digging more into like the differences between the two, and I realized how repressed I was in my own feminine energy, and it like it literally like it honestly it felt like someone like shattered like a window or something for me, because I was like, holy crap, like I have been tapping into my masculine more than I have been tapping into my feminine, because I was like encouraged to do that. Very interesting, because I feel like there are people that are more tuned into their feminine energy, because and maybe a little too much, to the point where like they're very emotion focused, and there needs to be a bit of a balance. But maybe we can do this on another episode. I don't know, but I know that for myself, I experienced four, the parents' tendency to punish, and definitely five, the minimization, definitely five. Like you think you have it hard, we had it worse, or there's someone that has it worse than you. And then bringing God into the mix, how would God feel knowing that you're so ungrateful? And then it was just like, oh, like don't bring God into this now. Now I'm a horrible human being. So the guilt and the shame, like all of it just is like this sick little cycle. But that has been my experience, and it is now my life's work to unlearn all of that and try to unlearn.
So these three supportive/unsupportive reactions that you just specified, the problem focused, the punitive reactions, and the minimization, you said, were you saying, I'm trying to understand, so were you saying that you identified these also as somewhat masculine?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
I do. A lot of it. So I like, and this is, I don't want to like derail us from what we're trying to do, but I do feel like when it comes to the sacred feminine energy, processing, especially emotional processing and emotional expression is very much a part of our strength. Whereas for masculine strength, a lot of it is moving forward and building, right? And so getting away, like, not getting away from something, but more like moving forward and picking up the pieces and less focus on the emotional aspect. So that, and that's where there's that connotation of like, oh well, women are emotional and men aren't. That's such bullshit. We all have masculine and feminine energies within us. It's a matter of learning how to regulate and use both, in a healthy way. But I know that for myself in my household, there was a like way more masculine than it was feminine, and I was discouraged from tapping into my feminine energy and my need to emotionally process, my need to cry, my need to talk about things and to give it weight and to understand what was happening. Like that was not encouraged in my household because that was not something that was ever encouraged in my parents' households because they came from
So
very
when
masculine households as well.
You talk about feminine versus masculine energy, you're not necessarily saying that this is a, are you necessarily saying that this is a patriarchal thing? Or because I know you also said that
Oh,
all
it
people
is.
have both. All people have
It is
both, though. You did say that. Both
100% a
feminine and
patriarchal
masculine.
thing. It is 100% a patriarchal thing. It is. It ties
That
into
we
that, but
allow that men and women are encouraged to express more of this masculine energy that you're referring to.
yeah, I mean, if anything, men are not to, when you want to talk about it from the context of the patriarchy, men have been socialized, and this is not just South Asian men, right? All men have been socialized to be tough, to be strong, to not express any vulnerability, to not express weakness. Like vulnerability equals weakness. But this has also translated over to everyone in general, right? Even as women, like we may be allowed to cry and to express ourselves, but how comfortable are we with that? And
And
from
how
the
comfortable
context,
are men with that?
how comfortable are men with that, right? And at the end of the day, it's like if you're telling me I'm allowed to cry and I'm allowed to be who I am and to explore my emotional needs and to express my emotional needs, what good is it if my partner doesn't even understand? Or what good is it if my partner doesn't even want to understand like where I'm coming from? Or it's so foreign to him because he's never even understood that, like he's never even understood that it's something that is allowed to begin with, right? There is like a disconnect. So not only does our culture not allow for us to explore our emotions within ourselves, but we're taught to kind of internalize it, like minimize it, like, oh, well, you're going through something, that's fine. Someone else has it way worse than you. So move on, find a solution, figure it out. Like what do you want me to tell you? Like there's no practical solution for me to help you, so I don't know how to help you, and that's your problem, not mine. So there's like that lack of accountability also. So I mean it's several things that impact this. The patriarchy is obviously the devil here. And it impacts everyone in so many ways. But in our culture, it's still like the woman still has to bear the brunt of that pain, of that burden, right? Like you don't want to be a burden on someone either. There's that the guilt and the shame that comes up. I don't want to be a burden on anyone, so I won't talk about what I'm going through, and so I'm going to hold it in, So even though you're allowed to be emotional, are you really?
Okay. So I'm trying to understand. I agree with everything that you're saying. What I'm trying to understand is the etymology of the feminine, or not etymology, but the like why are certain reactions labeled feminine and some reactions labeled as masculine? Is it because of the sort of intrinsic energy inside of us, or is it because we have been conditioned in a sort of way to see these energies in this way, and so therefore we have labeled that type of energy with feminine and masculine because as a response to society.
Got you. I'm going to go
Or
with the
is feminine
latter.
energy in okay, got it.
For me, I'm going to go with the latter, but what I think you said earlier, I think there is some merit to that. I'm not qualified to speak on that. It's not
Okay.
something,
Yeah,
yeah.
that's fair.
I'm not
That's
qualified to
fair.
speak on that. I'm not going to even pretend to know what the hell I am talking about, but I'm going to say I was conditioned to believe that there was a one way of there were two ways, like there's that binary of masculine versus feminine, and it's like if you're gonna be tough, you're gonna be like a man, and if you're gonna be weak, you're gonna be like a woman. So
Okay.
that's
Yeah, kind of the
where
way I see it is that I've the these reactions have these labels of feminine and masculine because of how society is conditioned is. But I do very much reject the gender binary. And so I try to reconcile, like when you talk about, like, I totally get what you're talking about. And I totally get that the brunt is on women. And it's like, I agree with all that stuff, obviously. But yeah, I do struggle a little bit to reconcile with like, what are these energy? What do they really mean? And is there really a dichotomy of them?
Yeah,
but I do agree I do agree that what we see as masculine and desirable and masculine energy is what you said, these like expressive and these action oriented things.
Action oriented, I like that. That's a really good descriptor. Action versus inaction. But again, like it all exists on like this binary, right? Which is very limiting. Yeah. It's a very limiting way of looking at life, but it's a very limiting way of looking at your emotions as well, because then you label your emotions as good or bad, not they just exist, which I think is a problem in our culture. Mm-hmm. Like, this just exists, you know, like, can you just be okay with the fact that like you feel this way? Why does it automatically have to be good or bad?
I do think that it's useful to see this in terms in this way, in terms of parenting. Because so much of our cultural references to parenting have this gender binary, the mom and the dad.
Yeah.
And so the way that our parents operate is based off of that model.
Yeah.
Of mom and dad.
Yeah.
You know, I was looking into India's old as hell, right? So a lot of Indian cultural values is going to be influenced by ancient Hindu stuff. And so I started like kind of reading about it a little bit. And this is kind of stuff that we all know, right? I'll go through this quickly, that Hinduism sees parenting as a sacred dharma, like a duty, right? I mean, every religion sees, everybody sees parenting as like a sacred duty, right? But I'm reading it from a Hindu perspective because the oldest texts come from India. And dharma purportedly is to instill good values like harmony and respect for interpersonal relationships. We talked about harmony before, how we live in this collectivist culture, right? And so our parents raise us in a way so that our emotions contribute to harmony. The harmony is the priority here. Yeah. So then the article that I referenced when I talked about the six unsupportive and supportive strategies, it continues to mention an ancient Sanskrit text, the Natya Shastra. This was written kind of as a fifth Veda, and it translates to the science of dramatics. And so it was written in the context of theater. And so the reason I started looking into this is because it mentions Rasa theory, which is basically like an approach to emotions. Rasa means juice, essence, flavor. I'm pronouncing it with an SH because Bengali, but it's spelled RASA, Rasa culture. The idea behind this theory / culture is that understanding what emotions are helps us to capture the essence of reality that is intrinsic in everyone, and to understand the cognitive, moral, and spiritual components of each of these emotions. And the main emotions, the nine main emotions, okay, I should clarify, actually the rasas are considered the emotional response that emotions evoke. And if we're speaking specifically in the context of dancing, the emotions that are inspired in the spectator by the performance. So anyway, the nine major emotions are love, laughter, compassion, anger, perseverance, fear, disgust, wonder, and serenity. And to me, it shows how important, I don't know how much this really influenced the way that we deal with these emotions. I'm sure it has an influence, but to me, it at least shows how important the arts are in Indian culture, number one, and then also how ancient Indians categorized and ranked and expressed emotions. And today, Indian culture does still place a lot of importance on the expression of emotion, but the emphasis has changed. And so remember, like, by the way, that I'm talking about what humans could feel in general. I'm not talking about what humans can feel in general. I'm talking about the connotation of these emotions. So for example, like in Indian culture, happiness is taught to be an immature emotion. So only young children experience it. Like I mentioned before, that in that study I read about the Indian moms and their kids under five. And I'll post that article too on tdcpodcast.com. The happiness is taught to be an immature emotion, right? So like only young kids experience it, whereas in adults it's more fleeting, and in the emotions we place higher value on as adults is, or even as like older children, is contentment and well-being. The idea is that happiness is an emotion that you experience because you just don't realize what else is wrong with the world. And so you don't have the wherewithal to understand that it actually sucks here. Which is a horrible way to see things, but apparently this is how we're seeing this according to several studies. So then, you know, the Western connotation of these emotions are a little bit different, right? So for example, Hindu disgust more is like disenchantment, and like you're wary of the world. That's a very different definition than American disgust, which is more like nauseous.
This kind of reminds me of like stoicism a little bit, right? It's kind of just like detachment from like your prime. No, I'm saying this wrong. You know what I mean? Like just removing yourself, like taking a few steps back from your initial like gut emotional responses to something. This is kind of what it's reminding me of.
Like a primal reaction.
Yeah. So
stepping away from a primal, like,
right. So like, suppressing it, or maybe like, because I don't think stoicism is suppression at all. I think stoicism is more of like being, I don't know, it's like an elevated way of looking at things. So there's some level of like composure that you maintain throughout any sort of emotional reaction that you may have. So either like if you're going through something that's like very exciting or like very distressing, like you still maintain like a sense of composure. So like when I think of a stoic, I think of someone that is like unmovable, like unmoved by emotions. So like this is kind of what it's reminding me of a bit.
Well, that's one of the steps to receive like enlightenment, to reach nirvana in Hinduism, right? It's stoicism is part of that.
Yeah. I just realized that.
In Buddhism, that's a concept in Buddhism too.
Yeah, that's so interesting. So it comes from a place of enlightenment, but it becomes something negative, and when it comes to like parenting, or like there are negative consequences when it comes to parenting, which is interesting.
Yeah, the idea behind this too, this Rasa theory, is that like you reach a kind of enlightenment when you are able to experience all these nine emotions and like really, you know, and understand them in an intrinsic level. And so also this is why it applies to dramatics, because a good performance is categorized as one that can invoke these types of emotions in you. Think part, not them, right? You know how you're expressive with your face too. So it's kind of like that, basically.
Does this mean that Desi parents are trying to raise us to be little adults? Like, subconsciously? If they're raising us to see happiness as an immature emotion by age 10, what does that even mean?
I wonder. Okay, well, actually, no. The article that I read this in, there was a couple of them, and they were fairly recent. They were like mid 20 teens or even 2020s. I don't know. I don't think they're trying to make us adults. I think they're doing the best they can with what they have, and what they have is themselves having to grow up very quickly. I don't think it's intentional.
No, not by at any all. Means. Not at all. Not at all.
I think the intent is still to produce a moving on response to negative emotions, whether or not it's done in a supportive or non-supportive approach.
Mm-hmm.
My theory. Yeah. My personal two cents.
I agree. I think that something that I found really interesting is, like, with my parents, they use this approach of, like, moving on and problem solving and, you know, not diving too deeply into your emotional expressions, like, as a child, at least. And they have two children, my sister and I. And my sister was also, like, very, like, inclined to kind of internalize. But I, since a young age, was more expressive. And they would often say, like, you know, you both, like, we raised you the same way, but like, why do you keep wanting to, like, engage? Like, why? Like, why can't you just hold it in? You know, like, why do you need to talk about this? Why do you need to talk about things all the time? And there was this, like, discomfort around that.
You know, I think, what? So finish what you're saying, then I have something to say. Sorry.
Okay. Why I bring that up is because they automatically assume that because as parents, like, they taught us both one thing, like, why does one child get it and the other not get it? And now as, like, an adult, like, I now, like, understand, like, each child has different emotional needs and ways of, like, expressing themselves. And yet there was just this one way to parent and this one way to do things. At least, like, in the eyes of my parents. So I really don't think that they were trying to make us little adults. I think that they were trying to help us move on with our lives and, like, get, you know, get acquainted with reality. But I always, like, resisted that because it just wasn't in my nature to suppress and to internalize. You know, now as an adult, as I look back and I, like, see, like, what happened, they were doing the best that they could, you know, as all of our parents do. All of our parents will, you know, they have the tools. They have some tools, and they're going to use those tools to parent. They may not have all the tools, but what I found interesting was that they were just trying to teach me what they knew. And when I realized that, I was able to forgive them for all that time where I felt like, you know, I couldn't even, like, be myself, and I couldn't even explore myself, and I couldn't even express myself emotionally. But now, like, it's 2023, and, like, there's, you know, mental health is a topic, and emotional expression is a topic, and unpacking mm-hmm. generational trauma is, these are all things that are, like, coming up. And as I'm, like, diving into it, I'm starting to, like, understand that, like, coming to my true self is to express myself emotionally. I forgot why I mentioned all of this, but I want you to say what you're going to say, because it'll come to me later.
Yeah, it's so, this is really interesting, because in the past I've read, like, in other publications, that mood disorders in Eastern cultures tend to present somatically. So, like, think gastrointestinal issues, whereas in Western culture, it's more cognitive. Like, we think about anxiety, right? You get anxiety and suddenly you've got, like, a stomach ache, right? And I wonder if it has to do with how we identify and sort of prioritize emotions, and what you're saying, suppress emotions. None of this, by the way, has been explored, as far as I realize, in any kind of real empirical research or studies. But it's an interesting thing to think about. We start to see similarities in modern day Indian culture and, like, this ancient Indian culture way of, like, prioritizing certain emotions over others.
Yeah. I think it's interesting to think about that when you have a child, like, under the age of 25, like, you know, you're, like, the brain is still developing, and you haven't reached the maturity yet. So to kind of push that, like, those, like, that, like, stoicism onto them at such a young age, like, before age 10, like, is that going to be helpful? Is that something that will help them mature into their, like, in healthy, like, adults. You know, like there are some people that are more inclined to emotionally regulate in that way, but not everyone can and not everyone will. And so I think that's where like that's where a lot of the issues arise when parents cannot meet those emotional needs of children that want to emotionally express themselves. Like it's in their nature to do that. That's where there's a lot of pain and a lot of like there's a lot of emotional needs that get unmet.
Parenting seems really fucking hard.
Yeah,
I think to say the obvious, parenting seems hard.
Yeah,
I don't blame any. I don't want to say I don't blame any parents. I'm talking about people who have normal relationship with their parents. Not like abusive stuff, but I don't blame like most parents for parenting the way that they did because. I think like any parent kind of goes into it with like, okay, what is the formula for having a baby and socializing and emotionally socializing this baby? And they just do it in the way that they think is right. And Indian culture does it in a certain way and Western culture does it in a certain way.
Can we talk about how like Desi parents will kind of copy and mimic like what their friends will do or like what their relatives will do? So like if their relatives will... I have 100% seen that.
Okay,
I've 100% seen that. So like the whole collective, the entire like the concept of collectivism, like the we culture, it's things are more acceptable. Like let's say like we have a group of like four families, like they're all friends, they all have young kids, they all hang out together, you know, they have these friendships and relationships with one another. If one parent decides that they want to start taking their child to play basketball or something, or I don't know, like I'm just using basketball as like an example. Then, but before that child like went to play basketball, it was kind of just like, oh, well, we don't need to put our kids into sports, you know, like I just want to watch my child all the time. Like,
and then suddenly like everybody else is doing it. But is that exclusive really to like Indian parents?
I don't think so. I don't think that it's exclusive to just us, but I do feel like it. I do feel like there is that, you know, like
there is an extra layer of us caring about what other people are doing. I think that's what you're trying to say.
That's what I'm trying to get at. That's what I'm trying to get at. And I'm doing a terrible job at.
it's the like what will people say type of thing. It's like well, nobody will say anything if we do the same things as everybody else.
Right.
I want to start wrapping this up. Our big question of the day, I think, is like what is the impact of the way that South Asian culture views and deals with emotions on the wellness and socialization of their children? And I think some of the big points that we brought up, we mentioned that happiness needs to be sustained for as long as possible. What else did we say? We mentioned the danger in stoicism. And I think we also talked about prioritizing and deprioritizing certain emotions. And then also actually we talked about the supportive and unsupportive strategies of socializing, like types of reactions, like problem focus, emotion, whatever, punitive. And we talked a little bit about the history of those things and where they may have come from, like partly from the perdition and maybe even like further back in ancient India. But what do you think, like, or what are we hoping the future kind of looks like for South Asian cultural shifts? I don't think that we need to adopt American values or Western values.
No, that's not at all what I was thinking.
I don't think that that's at all the solution, because I could find you a ton of studies that like give you all the issues with Western parenting too. But I want to know, like, staying true to South Asian culture, how do we still have good emotional relationships with our parents?
I think first and foremost, this is based off a conversation that I had recently with one of my friends who's also Desi. I think that we need to think about unity.
But that's the thing. We do. We talk. Well, I mentioned harmony several times in the episode.
But harmony and unity are different things, right? Harmony is like, okay. There's no, nobody's like, nobody is going to rock the boat and no one's going to be an outlier and no one's going to be like,
that's fair.
You know,
I agree.
What is the fucking word? Sorry, I cursed. like the divergent. No one's gonna be like the divergent. Like no one's gonna stick out like a sore thumb. That's harmony. But unity is like supporting one another while we are authentically ourselves, like warts and all, right? So I think that what for the future, what I envision for the future of South Asians is to build trust with one another and to trust ourselves. Only when we trust ourselves and know ourselves can we do that for other people, right? So, and I think there's a severe lacking in that, and within South Asian culture in general. Like, there is this lack of like brotherhood and unity. Like, I don't know about yourself, but like, I feel almost like when I see like groups of South Asians, like I feel like I'm being sized up. And that feeling of like, I don't know if I'm going to be accepted or not, you know? And
You're not
that
wrong
feeling.
to, yeah. Go ahead.
What are
I'll
your
say what I'm saying
thoughts?
after. Well,
Okay,
I was
yeah,
gonna say you're
so.
not wrong to feel that way around Indians, because out of all the other countries, we tend to criticize each other the most. Like, you'll hear people who traveled the whole world and they're like, damn, nobody hates Indians as much as Indians hate Indians. And like,
Yeah,
you
that's what I'm
think
trying
about
to,
the
yeah.
Amritsar
That's what I'm
massacre, prime
saying.
example, where the British
Yeah.
army was able to get Indians to attack themselves.
Right, exactly. Ex like
They
this
weren't
shit
able to get anyone
goes
else to do
deep.
that. They weren't able to get China to do that. I mean,
Yeah.
the
Right.
Indians.
Right.
You're right
And
to feel that way. A
doesn't
lot of people say that.
I feel that way. Like, I have like a visceral reaction to that, and that will I don't know if that's ever going to change. I hope it changes, but I think that you're to answer your question, like the future, I want that shit to be gone. I want that to be gone. I want there to be real unity. I want there to be real trust, real brotherhood, sisterhood. And then only can we reshape what it means to be a good parent to our children. Then only can we understand what it means to have emotionally intimate relationships with them. Because I think that the furthest it ever goes is trust only your blood and no one else. Like, why? You know? I want that to change, because even that breeds such a lack of trust in others. And I think that really screws children up. It screws up South Asian children, because then they have friend groups. They make friends with one another and don't even like each other, don't even trust each other, but then they hang out with each other all the time. It's just freaking strange and weird. But I want to see less of that, and I want to see more of real connection, more unity, more emotional intimacy, more authenticity, more vulnerability. That's what I want in the future, and I hope for that, and I want to be
And
alive to see that.
we think that unity is the step towards it. I agree. I think without unity, what do we have really? We have panic. We just
Yes,
panic about what
and
other people are
chaos.
thinking and
Yeah,
doing, and yeah, we have chaos and
it's
panic.
disingenuous. It's not. Yeah, the it's it, there. It's like filtered thoughts and carefully curated communication and carefully curated relationships that probably lack substance and true
Carefully curated
intimacy.
emotions.
Yeah,
Yeah.
these are my thoughts.
So, on that note, I am so excited to get into the next episode. Next time we get here, we'll be talking a little more deeply about like different types, more specific types of immature parents, and also coping mechanisms. So, and then we'll refer more to the book that we talked about in the beginning of the episode, Adult Children of Emotionally Immature Parents, which I know I had my criticisms about it from a cultural perspective, but I do think it's a very good read for everyone. There were
Agreed.
some nice little coping strategies in there too, and lots of anecdotal stories that I think that you could, a lot of people can probably relate to. So I'm looking forward to that. What do you think?
Me too. I can't wait. This was a heavy episode. I know we covered so much, but it'll be nice to kind of get into some of the anecdotal pieces from our own lives in the next episode. I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah, it feels more actionable. So stay tuned. Come back to us when we post the next episode. Keep up with us on our socials, The Desi Condition. We're also on Threads now. Where else are we? I used to say we were on Twitter, but that's Twitter.
X.
So we're on Instagram, we're on Threads, we are on email at thedesicondition@gmail.com. We are also online at TDC Podcast, which I think I mentioned at least three times in the episode, but I worked hard on that website. So TDCpodcast.com, where you will find all of the sources. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. We loved talking at you. We're going to love talking at you again next time. And we hope you tune in. Have a wonderful day and stay safe.